Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I am your host, Graham Culbertson. My guest today is Anthony Caldelis, who is a historian of the Eastern Roman Empire, which most people call Byzantium. And they call it Byzantium because Byzantium isn't really the Roman Empire. It's this weird thing where they had the wrong form of Christianity and they spoke Greek, not Latin. And it just generally was a bizarre distortion of the true Roman Empire. Now, this concept of Byzantium is just made up. It really was the Roman Empire, but there were people in the Western Roman Empire who were trying to claim that they were the real Romans, and so they had to make up this story for why the person who was actually, say, the Emperor of Rome in the Imperial Roman city of Constantinople in the year 1107 wasn't actually the Emperor of Rome. Now, this has enormous consequences because pretty much everyone who has theorized what a state is, what a citizen is, what governments should do in what is now called the West has used Roman terms to do so. And so since we are living in a world that defines itself via Rome, Anthony's book that explains that the version of Rome that those people used was a distorted one, a self-serving one, has enormous consequences. And in the course of this interview, you'll hear we get into what this means for the concept of the West, what it means for the concept of empire, of sovereignty, of Christianity. That's all in there. After the music, what you'll hear from Anthony and I is almost a recap of our earlier conversation where I talked about the way that the Roman Empire, as he describes it, could be thought of as a form of anarchy. Shocking, I know. I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. And then after a little chit-chat about anarchy, you'll hear the interview about Phantom Byzantium.
Anarchy away.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is, you know, this is where we ended up, or where we started in the other conversation is the idea that essentially anarchy is what's underlying the Res Publica, but not how people would traditionally define anarchy, but how, and as you mentioned, you know, they certainly wouldn't have called it anarchy, but the idea that underlying these structures of power is a fundamental democratic ability to shrug off or alter the structures of power. That's the like political science definition of anarchy. And I think that's there in the Res Publica book and in all of your work, really.
Well, yes. So most of the time they neither wanted anarchy nor had it. But there are these interesting moments of transition, which we might, I think, legitimately classify as states of exception, when the prevailing order seemed to be a sort of kind of thinner tissue of institutions than they might have wanted it to be, and where a kind of raw, a populist power comes to the fore. Now, that's a difficult sort of thing to channel. I mean, obviously, we see this every time it happens. And they were terrified of it, I think, quite rightly. But it did happen. And there's a question about whether we should take those few moments, however decisive, as kind of the norm versus the more stable centuries. But anyway, yes.
Yeah, and well, let's get to Phantom Byzantium in a second. But the, I mean, another thing is just that, what's that opening, the opening quote in the Res Publica book, where the emperor says, you know, when laws were made and the people didn't like them, they just didn't follow them and the laws went away. I've tried this out on, you know, political theorists, and they say, like, well, if the people can just disregard it, then you don't have rule of law. And then I say, well, okay, then according to the Roman emperor, the Roman Empire didn't have rule of law. How do you feel about this claim? Your definition of rule of law and the Roman Empire's definition of rule and law are different, and the Roman Empire has a much more flexible and expansive one. And that's just another moment that challenges, yep, what people think.
Also, by their definition, quite possibly there has been no society and no state in the whole of history that has rule of law.
And no society has ever had sovereignty, in terms of complete control of the legitimate use of violence. This is just a fantasy that people have worked up.
Well, I mean, it's a theoretical model. So the question then is, you know, can certain fields, sort of scholarly research, intellectual, legal fields deal with the messiness of reality?
Ah. I agree. That's a great question. And I think my answer broadly is, you know, no, at least as political science has been practiced, let's say.
Right, but we rely on those fields to produce models for us to reduce the amount of chaos that we're willing to live with, right? Like, we don't want to live in a completely lawless and, you know, no rules, no structure, nobody wants that. Really,
nobody wants that.
Right. So I don't want to put those fields down, but because once they invest in their structures and their orders, then yeah, I mean, sometimes you end up with these kinds of problems where they don't recognize parts of reality, but yeah.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking this moment to recap a little bit of the Rome as Anarchy thing that we did last time, which, gosh, was like 3 or 4 years ago now. I needed to look it up, but it might have been 2022. But we are here today to discuss your new book, Phantom Byzantium. And I'm going to try and briefly summarize the main argument, and then you can tell me what I get wrong about it. But the argument roughly goes that this thing called the Roman Empire lasted until around 1453. And indeed, people who considered themselves Romans lasted much longer than that, into the 19th. And I think you've even got some accounts of people still considering themselves in what we would call Greece Roman into the 20th century. Meanwhile, this thing, which is called the West, or Europe, is born, and it occupies the western part of what used to be the Roman Empire. And starting from the very beginning of this thing called the West, starting with Charlemagne or Charlemagne's grandfather or the popes, these people in this thing that used to be the western half of the Roman Empire are invested in being the real Romans. And they have this problem, which is that real Romans with a Roman state still exist. So they create this concept, which now goes by the name Byzantium. You would call it the Eastern Roman Empire, the real thing. But Byzantium, which is everything that the West, which they also conceive of as Rome, isn't. And in order to claim themselves as the real Roman, so that Charlemagne can call himself a Kaiser, even though there's an actual Caesar ruling at the time of Charlemagne, he has to have this way that the Eastern Roman Empire is not really Roman. And this goes on and on and on into the Renaissance, all along to this very day. Historians have to say there's this thing called the West. It's a descendant of the Roman Empire, and it is not the same thing as the Roman Empire that actually existed from around the year 500 to around the year 1500, to be really rough and loose with the date. So how does that sound as a beginning? I think the thing I sent you via email was better, but I did that off the cuff.
I see. I mean, for doing it off the cuff, that's pretty good. However, I need to say that what you just described is one plank of three. Mm. Now, the overall argument of the book makes that argument three times in connection with three, let's say, legacies, traditions, identities that the West really did appropriate from the East, reformulated them as in their essence Western, and then denied them to the East from whence it took them, right? And that this happened with the Roman tradition, as you just explained. The book also talks about how this is done with the Christian tradition and with, and later with the classical Greek one. So that through the iteration of these three cycles, the Eastern Empire is successively stripped of its defining cultural attributes. Those are appropriated by the West through processes that are explicitly called in Latin translatio. That is a kind of, let's say, migration of either the Roman imperial title or of the proper forms of Christianity or of Hellenist scholarship during the Renaissance and afterwards from the East to the West. And the society from which they came is retroactively redefined as unworthy of those traditions, and its identity is uncoupled from them. So that it's not properly Roman, it's Greek, it's not properly Christian, it's schismatic, or later during the Enlightenment, superstitious. It's not properly Greek, it's kind of degenerate because they don't, you know, they forgot how to pronounce Greek, or, you know, they're not interested in the classical stuff. And so the Eastern Roman Empire, called or polity, or what, you know, its whole society and culture just becomes kind of like this empty vessel that functions as an inversion of the best form of these cultural attributes that the West aspires to be. We're the proper Romans. We do proper classical scholarship. We're the correct, you know, norm for Christianity. What's happening over there is the degenerate version of all of those three things. And that is the matrix from which the very concept of Byzantium emerges. That's why we have it. It is there to capture that, the end product of that dynamic of appropriation and then delegitimization.
So that, I mean, that strikes me as all exactly right. Except the only thing I would say is, you know, I'm sort of using Romanness as a, you know, as a metonym for all three of these things. I mean, this gets us into the complexity of Roman identity. I mean, even in your three strands, one of them is Greekness that the West has, and one of them is Greekness that the East has, because we all know that the Roman Empire is supposed to be Greek in a substantial way. And we all also know, well, maybe we don't all know. I don't know who all is listening to this and how invested they are in the Roman Empire. But we also all know that the Roman Empire is not supposed to be Greek in certain ways, that being Greek is bad. So when I say that they're trying to claim Romanness, I'm including, or I would normally include Greekness and Christianity in the concept of Romanness, with the problem that, of course, since this civilization lasted for around 2,000 years or so, or let's say this polity, I shouldn't say civilization, since this polity lasted for around 2,000 years or so, it was actually many things. It was bureaucratic at some times and not bureaucratic at others. It was Christian at some times and not Christian at others. But they picked the three aspects of Romanness that they wanted to be, and they being this whole 1,000 or 1,500 year plus lineage of people living in what we would now call Western Europe, and then eventually, you know, in the United States, the country we are now in. There's a reason why there's George Washington is depicted holding a fascist, the Roman symbol of imperial power, in the Capitol building, because Americans also want to be this kind of Roman, the right kind of Christianity, knowing about Plato and Aristotle, and also the relationship between Plato and Aristotle and people like Polybius and Tacitus. And I've forgotten the third strand. Oh, yes, of course, having the martial virtues and Romanness and the republican institutions, which is why we have a Senate in this country as well. And the argument goes that those things existed, not at the time of the founding of the United States, but at the existed at the time of the Holy Roman Empire, and even in the early stages of the Renaissance, and they had to be denied to the East. And that's this made up thing, Byzantium, where they got Christianity. They have Christianity, but they just screwed up and they got the wrong kind of Christianity. And the real Christianity is over here where we are, the West.
Yeah, well, it's not that they got the wrong version of Christianity. They developed the right one. Look, let's not forget, the New Testament is written in Greek. Most of the early church fathers, they wrote in Greek in the East. Most of the ecumenical councils took place within a certain number of miles from Constantinople, and were conducted mostly in Greek. So it was impossible for anyone in the West to say that Eastern Christianity has been wrong from the get-go, because that would pull the rug out from under their feet as well. So what they had to do instead was try to figure out when it deviated. And literally that meant, which of those authors and councils do we in the West want to appropriate for our own tradition, that is, to label them as Catholic, after which point we can leave the dregs to the East and assume that that's when they became like modern Greeks who are cut off from the authentic Mother Church of Rome. So, yeah. So, and the same happens with the Roman imperial tradition. That is, there's a reason why so many Western textbooks go down to Justinian, because without Justinian, you don't have Roman law, even in the West. And Justinian, an emperor in Constantinople, who never went right west of the Adriatic, is nevertheless regarded as a Roman emperor because he has to be, because without him, you don't have Roman law in the West. However, those same textbooks are not interested in his immediate predecessors or in any of his successors, really, because they can just be discarded. Like, we don't need those, and so we discard them in the West. The East can keep them. And this is a process that just keeps being repeated over and over again. It's the same with classical studies. When you ask classicists, like, how late... Look, the Greek literary tradition doesn't, like, stop, right? It's a Greek language. It was written from then down to today. You know, the language changes at some point. The literature begins to be more in modern Greek than in ancient Greek. But that's during the Ottoman period, right? And so you ask classicists, at what point you cut things off and claim, well, up until this point, it is classical and therefore ours. After that, it's just ethnic studies. It's area studies. It's whatever. Like, those Greeks can study their own. We don't care. And this is arbitrary points that are decided by what, you know, those Western scholars in their disciplines and traditions find useful for themselves. And when they want the cutoff to be Demosthenes, because everything after that is degenerate, that's what they do. And that's what they did 120 years ago. That was the cutoff point. And then the cutoff point started moving later and later and later until today. It's somewhere in the 3rd century AD. It is 100% arbitrary. There is no major changes in literature or the language or the genres or the nothing in the 3rd century. It's just that for whatever cultural reasons that have to do with today, they don't want to deal with Christian authors. Classicists are kind of, many of them, allergic to Christianity, and they're like, ugh, that's class. But you can't really imagine, for example, a field of like English literature, right? That's, well, I'm not, I don't deal with authors who were like, I don't know, Catholic, only the Protestant. Like, it's so bizarre. Like, that would just seem crazy. But that's exactly what the Hellenic studies and the classical studies does. Anyway, yeah. So to respond to the beginning of your last comment was, yes, these things, these three elements, let's say, are interlinked. Right, so that when you invoke Rome in many contexts, that also invokes like Christendom, and sometimes vice versa. In the medieval West, these two things are very, very linked. But I like to keep them separate in my mind for analytical purposes, because there are moments when they function either independently of each other or sometimes in tension with each other. So in particular, like Rome and Greece are sometimes competing poles of, let's say, cultural loyalty in, you know, certainly the 18th and 19th centuries, right? Also, you will find like France is more drawn to the Roman tradition, the British and the Germans more to the Greek tradition, though, you know, they can switch over depending on what they're emphasizing, right? The British Empire is one thing. British literature is another thing. So one is more Roman, one is more Greek. Also, you have some tensions between the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire. Sometimes empire is like what Rome is about, and sometimes it's republic, as you've seen the founding, you know, the United States, for example, and so forth. So I like to keep these things in their own little, you know, baskets, because sometimes they do function independently of each other. Yeah.
So that, I mean, that all makes sense. That's perfect. I just need to say one thing about my field, because I'm in an English department, which is in American literature, the Catholic English writers of the 17th century were not really considered American literature for a long time, because the lineage of America was supposed to go from the Pilgrims through the Massachusetts Bay Colony into Pennsylvania and the Quakers, and the fact that there was Church of England and also Catholic Spanish people in these places was considered a great embarrassment. I guess it's more what we would call Anglican than Catholic, but either way, the fact that they were not Calvinist was a problem, because right. There was this lineage that went from the Pilgrim Fathers through Emerson into the flowering of American literature. And so if someone, you know, most famously, this guy, John Smith, who everyone knows from the Pocahontas story, he wrote a lot, and he's read now in those classes, he's in the anthologies, but he wasn't for a while, because he wasn't the right kind of writer of English literature in the Americas. So he was not part of the lineage. We play that game. I mean, as you say now, it would be considered unheard of to say, no, we don't read that kind of literature in English written by an American because their religion is wrong. But yep. 30 years ago, definitely 50 years ago, you would hear that. That's not the right kind. He's the wrong kind of Christianity, so we don't read him.
Right. Yes, this was explicitly stated in classics textbooks 50 years ago. Now it's implicitly practiced. They don't, obviously they don't like to say that, because once you say it, it sounds, yeah. But it's very, very strong still in, for example, Arabic studies. So for a very, very long time, the study of Arabic literature was understood to be the study of Muslim Arabic literature. And all of these masses and masses and masses of, let's say, Christian Arabic literature were just kind of relegated to, you know, one or two scholars who are sort of interested in it. And these separate discipline emerged of Christian Arabic. And I don't think they've reached a point now of convergence where those two fields are even talking to each other very much. I mean, they're starting to, but I don't think it's really penetrated this kind of, you know, this understanding that, anyway, okay, this is a different situation, But we see this in other fields too, right? So, for example, to bring it back to the many, many fields that study the materials from the civilization I study, so classicists claim their own little bit, but like Catholic patristic interest claims a different bit, but they're both claiming it, right? And leaving the rest to, well, someone else can go study the stuff that doesn't, that we have not put into our own constructed cultural genealogy.
Yeah, no, the leftover bits belong to someone else. That makes complete sense, which is why you get I'll mention my field again, then we can move on. You get things like studies in the American Catholic novel, in which right. they go through and they assemble all of the Catholic novelists, and there's a book on just them. And maybe these Catholic novelists live 200 years apart and have absolutely nothing in common, but now there's a constructed yeah. tradition, the Catholic American novel. And it's, yes. you know, yeah. It's exactly what we sort of opened this conversation talking about. You've got these constructed traditions and you need to make them work because you want certain things in them and certain things outside of them. I don't know if you remember, but we were talking after our last conversation years ago about maybe doing another episode about what Rome meant for the Western thinkers. I think particularly in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, like why there was this so much talk about Rome and the Roman Empire, and they were, you know, reading Polybius and that sort of thing. And after we talked about it a little bit, we concluded it was not something you could talk about in 45 minutes in a podcast episode. It was an enormous project. Reading this book, it strikes me that this book is in some ways the answer to this question. What did Rome mean to the people who were theorizing Europe or the West over the last 500 years or so? And I'm wondering if you thought although from a different angle, and I'm wondering if you thought it was sort of that same question from a different angle, or if I'm off on that.
No, you're not off. It is the same question, but in this book, I deal with that question through a very particular keyhole. Like I look at it through a keyhole, which is insofar as it pertains to the appropriation of materials from the Eastern Roman polity. And I can't possibly, look, this is a book, 170 pages that surveys a millennium and a half. So I'm trying to hit some of the main points where certain shifts took place or certain developments were pushed to the next level in the understanding and construction of the idea of first the Greek Empire and later, quote, Byzantium. And I can't possibly begin to give a more sort of comprehensive, rounded history of the West's perception of itself in all of these domains, be it Roman, be it whatever. That there's way too much left out because it concerns internal Western debates that have nothing to do with what they're interested in the culture I study. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what emerges is these key aspects of Western identity that people, and I mean, we can say all of the provisos now, these elite people who were trying to create this identity as Roman. So you can see what Rome meant to them, if it was something that they consciously saw was in Byzantium or the Eastern Roman Empire, and they had to explicitly disavow it. If there's something in Byzantium they're disavowing the relationship between Byzantium and Rome and that thing, then you know that's one of the things they want. Like, for example, they want the title Caesar, Kaiser, Tsar, Emperor. And so then Basilius, then the guy in Constantinople has to not be the Caesar if you are going to be the Caesar.
Exactly. So a different way to put it is to lift a phrase from modern political discourse, which is every accusation is a confession, right? Some of your listeners may have heard this in connection with American politics right now, and specifically with one party. That is a fairly good way. I mean, I think you're articulating exactly this point. It's a fairly good way of tracking what they're interested in is to look at the focus points of their abuse. Right? So exactly what are they accusing the Easterners of? This is precisely what they want to appropriate from them, make it their own, and leave the empty husk behind in the East. So yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, excellent. Let's I want to push on a little bit to some of the big picture questions here. And I mean, these are like, this is another topic that, you know, you can talk about. And people have written many, many, many books on the topic of the West and what it means. But to try and get to it this way, I mean, in some really crucial way, the West is the descendants of Romanness, Christian Romanness with a classical Greek heritage as well. And then this moves across the Atlantic also to the United States. And then, you know, my friends who study Asia, we don't really know what to do with South Korea and Japan and this concept of the West, because it so clearly is, they so clearly fit our definition of the West in so many ways. But also, you'll rarely hear people make the argument that Japan is part of the West. But we can leave that aside for now. That's not something you and I need to talk about. Sorry. So if the West is Christian, a Roman polity with a Christian heritage, and a classical Greek heritage, and is a civilization clashing with Muslim civilization, if you can even have that if you want it, how do we write a history of the West now, if this argument is correct? Because then Constantinople becomes in some ways the center of Western culture for at least 500 years, maybe even 1,000 years. And then the West starts to look like what has been called the West, Western Europe, and later the United States, starts to look like the phantom. Can the field of Western studies handle this, or what can they do? Maybe that's the wrong question. Forget that. Let's just say, how would you handle this question of what the West is and what it means if there actually was a Roman polity all through this period that the West was constituting itself?
Right. Okay. So we're not going to solve, you know, all the problems associated with the concept and the category of the West today. However, I think it should be possible to define the space in which my argument is operating. And I would invite your listeners to think of the West not as a stable historical entity, or even as one that exists because of certain definitional properties by which we define it. Though it's always trying to do that, but if you try to follow those definitions that it gives, you will always end up with this kind of surplus that you can't explain, or gaps that you can't explain, exactly as you just said. I mean, even like, you know, Japan or whatever, like, or Constantinople for that matter. Like, anytime you try to define the West, those definitions start producing problems, and there's a gap always, right, between the definition and reality. So I don't take that approach. I treat, let's say, the West in the same way that I would any other constructed historical social identity. In other words, like saying, you know, the Greeks or the Romans or the Americans or whatever, which is to say, or for that matter, even something like races, right? Like, these aren't actual biological things. For the most part, the ways in which they are not the socially interesting ones. They're not the ones that actually give rise to the historical phenomenon of race, right, as a social discourse. So these are constructed categories and identities that evolve over time. The most interesting thing is that there are certain people invested in them who, you know, are talking about usually, you know, how this group is constituted this way, or why it's great and other groups are not great, and, you know, or the dangers faced by our group and the anxieties of it and all of these things, right? Pride, anxiety, right? When you start seeing those things associated with certain key terms, then you know, aha, I have here a kind of, you know, conceptual social construct that is, however like imaginary or fuzzy it might seem to an actual historian, nevertheless acting in the world. It's producing real world consequences in the same way that, that the ideas of race do, right? I mean, you know, I have actually met even faculty here at University of Chicago who believe that, that race is such an invented thing that you cannot and should not even discuss it. You cannot talk about race without being racist. And like, yeah, but you understand that this is a concept with real world consequences when people believe it. It doesn't have to be real, right? Like Pizzagate wasn't real, but people acted on it, right? So it's the same with the West. I'm not committed in it to any particular definition. I'm interested in historical individuals who have an idea, that idea or a homologous idea. I mean, the name changes a little bit. And they're willing to see the world that way, right? And so there is a very interesting overlap between, say, things like the area of broader Frankish influence, you know, in and after the ninth century. This would point to Bartlett's book, you know, the idea of, I can't remember the exact title now, but it's about, so the Frankish role in the creation of the idea, the origins of Europe.
Yeah. Right.
The parts of the world where crusaders tended to come from, the parts of the world that used Latin as their liturgical language in the Middle Ages, right? The parts of the world where Latin scholarship on the Eastern Empire began to be produced, you know, in the 16th century and afterwards, the parts of the world that tended to concentrate, you know, that had centers of power, wealth, and empire between the 17th and the 20th centuries, and the part of the world that produced the most modern bibliography on Byzantium. Those parts of the world all tend to overlap. You know, and it's not a coincidence. And lo and behold, those are the parts of the world that were most invested in the appropriation of the three cultural elements that we were talking about earlier from the East. Those are the parts of the world that have made those central components of their cultural genealogy, right? That we have Rome in these following respects, and we are Christian or even post-Christian, but, you know, we have Christian values in these kinds of ways. Or, you know, we study classical, you know, languages, like Greek and Latin, and Greek poetry and, or, you know, philosophy and democracy and rhetoric. These are all parts of our, right, culture. Well, all those parts of the world overlap, right? At least down to 1900, that's pretty much where these things are done. So accordingly, you find that people in those parts of the world are self-aware of this. And this is where the concept of the West by whatever name emerges. It emerges from people who are self-conscious about these facts and who think that those facts constitute a kind of identity of us versus the rest of the world. And it is that identity that is very productive in creating the modern identity enjoyed, in quotation marks, by my field, Byzantium, in the sense that Byzantium and, let's say, Western Europe or the West co-constituted each other. They were defined in relation to each other, the one positively, the other negatively. And those are linked processes. They are, in fact, the same process. They're just the other side of the coin, right? So this is not similar to the way in which, let's say, medieval Christendom defined itself in opposition to Islam. That was a very different kind of opposition. This is one that's much, much closer. The one that I'm talking about, it's kind of flip side of the same coin. And it has a very different dynamic. So, you want to talk about the constitutive elements of the, like, maybe we should talk about the names of the West, by the way, because there's considerable confusion about this, especially when modern historians or scholars who work on the modern period, when they write about the invention of the idea of the West, they get it wrong. And they get it wrong because they don't read medieval sources. In medieval sources, I'm talking about Western medieval sources in Latin, it's quite common to distinguish between the East and the West. And by that, they have something relatively specific in mind, which is the distinction between the Latin and the Greek churches. Now, this also happens to map onto the division between the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire. And sometimes they have that division in mind, too. So East and West are referring to, let's say, roughly the two halves of the Roman Empire, plus the parts of the world that are, you know, sort of Catholic, Latin Rite, and the parts that are Greek Rite. So you find in many, many church documents, the church being the institution that for a number of centuries is the one that most preserves records about how people felt, you know, about all of this. Well, they will say the Westerners, the Easterners, the West, the East, all the time. And all of those translationes that I mentioned, the appropriation and assimilation of cultural elements from the East to the West, we're described in those terms, from East to West, right? And so they have this idea of the West. There are even people who write histories of the West in like the 13th century, things like this, or the Western Church or whatever. The shift really happens in the 16th century. Late 15th, that early 16th century, when you start to have the idea of Europe take over from either the West or Christendom. They kind of overlap for a long time. Then the West comes back again in the late 19th century. When they understand that what the West is no longer just Europe. I mean, there's a lot more of the West around the world. So it just gets called the West again, and here we are.
Yeah, I think it makes sense that the United States is the, and my apologies, Canada, are the reason why you need the West that is not the same as Europe.
Yes, and I would also invite your audience to reflect for a moment on how odd it is that a civilization that, or not a civilization, but, you know, this sort of whatever cultural identity cluster that we call the West, calls itself by what is actually a decentering term. Even though it is an imperial hegemon and imagines itself as the sort of vanguard of modernity, progress, power, wealth, as civilization, has always done so. Like, we're right. We're doing we've got the right solutions to problems and so forth. Nevertheless, it has used a decentering the West for itself for some time. And this is kind of strange. Most civilizations don't do this. Most you know, talk about themselves as being in the middle of things, right?
Yeah.
There are very few exceptions, like Northmen, you know, the Norse, you know, that kind of thing. But that's always in relation to, you know, centers of power in the South that they were very aware of. I imagine. Anyway, so the question is, why the West? There's no center, right? The West isn't west of a particular center that we're all supposed to be looking at. Occasionally, you know, maybe it'd be Rome, but Rome is actually the heart of the West, insofar as you wanted to define it in a Catholic way. So that doesn't work. No, the West is the West because of Constantinople. Constantinople is the East, right, to which the West is the West.
Yeah. And so the West is off to the side. It's peripheral from the big imperial power, and that big imperial power doesn't exist during the time that the West is defining itself.
Well, this has been the dream, right, of so many Western hegemons to reconstitute that power, right? But they dream of it. They never really come close. Napoleon, you know, Charlemagne. Walter Scheidel has written a book about this, Escape from Rome, why a unifying empire was never created again in the West after the fall of the Western Empire. Unlike, for example, in China, where every time it falls apart, it's eventually reconstituted. Like, the idea of a unified empire there is strong, not just in theory, but also in practice.
Yeah, I actually still haven't read any Walter Scheidel, but I have a friend, Luke Kemp, who comes on the podcast frequently, and he mentions Walter Scheidel every time. So I need to.
Every time. Okay, well, I guess I have two now.
So, I mean, this concept takes us right to where I wanted to go, you know, for our concluding section, which is, you know, this question of Western civilization. There's this story, and it starts, I mean, I didn't realize until relatively recently the reason why we studied Egypt. I thought we studied Egypt just because it was old, but it turns out it's Western culture starts in Egypt and then goes to Greece and blah blah blah, etc., and then ends up at a elementary school in Florida where I was taught about the pharaohs because I am in some strange way the inheritor of that civilization. But there's another problem or another version of the West, and this goes back again to this question that we talked about: what do they want in the 15th and 16th century? Which is, in one thing, what the Italians who did what we now call the Renaissance. In some ways, they were they thought, and I think they've generally been accepted by most people who study the West, have accepted this, that 1,000 years. Between, you know, 500 to 1500 ish, or 300 to 1300, whatever your dark ages are, the democratic and republican practices that the Greeks and the Romans had sort of went away. They were in abeyance, and you had the dark ages, and Western Europe for this 1,000 years is supposed to be tyranny, and then it's rediscovered, essentially, these classical political figures, classical political structures are rediscovered. And that's why the two major parties in the United States are the Democrats and the Republicans. They're both calling back to these ways of classical governance. Now, I'm interested in this concept of the Res Publica, the idea that there was a form of republican governance in the Roman Empire, and that means also the Eastern Roman Empire that you studied. And so I'm wondering, I mean, you can take this any way you want, instead of this story of like democratic republican governance went away for 1,000 years and then was reborn in Italy around the same time that Constantinople fell, not exactly the same time, but around the same time, could we say instead that, you know, this republican form of government moved over? Did the Res Publica of the Romans just sort of shift west, and now it still exists in this much more diffuse form, but that's why we have senators and other democratic republican forms? Or is this another narrative that's too sketchy and out there? I don't know. Maybe that's too big a jumble, but take it any way you want it.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I wouldn't go that far for the following reasons. First of all, that there were republics throughout the Western Middle Ages. I mean, Venice, for example, was always regarded as such a thing, and a number of other Italian cities either really or retroactively invented the histories for themselves that, you know, they were Republican. I wouldn't go that far for the following reason. My understanding of the term Res Publica in its original Latin meaning and its corresponding Greek term politia, which was used as a kind of translation of it in the East, does not refer to a particular type of regime that is a formal structure of power. We use the term that way. So when we refer to, quote, the Republic in distinction to the Empire, we're implying that Res Publica is a particular type of institutional regime. But the word has had that meaning really only since the 18th century. Mm-hmm. That's not how the Romans understood it. That's not how people in the Middle Ages understood it. That's not how people in Constantinople understood it. It was a much more diffuse sense of a commonality of purpose, identity, law, custom, and so forth among people who make up a lawfully governed, you know, politically stable polity, regardless of how it was governed. And that's why even if you look at the classic treatise on the De Republica by Cicero, this Cicero, right, as first century BC, toward the end of the period that we call the Republic, the Romans did not call it that. And he says, well, a res publica can be governed by a king. It can be governed by an oligarchy, or, I mean, a senate, an aristocracy, or it can be governed by the people, in which case it's a democracy. And let's take each of these in turn, and which, you know, and he examines the pros and cons of each one, which means that here is our leading Roman theorist of politics on the record talking about the res publica, and it is not for him a matter of the formal structures of governance and power. It's more a matter of other things that I just mentioned also, like what is the purpose of power, who does it benefit, you know, ideas about the common good, these kinds of things. So, for example, when you have an emperor who is of a different, let's say, I don't know, something like the Ottoman Empire, right? Where, you know, the Sultan is a Muslim and, you know, he speaks Turkish or whatever, and represents a particular, you know, culture's power or group of people's power. It could be dynastic, it could be religious, it could be whatever, that are not those of the majority of your subjects in, say, the Balkan provinces, who feel that they're ruled by a foreign. That is not a res publica by the Roman definition. That is not a unified state with the people having agreement on the laws and so forth. There are different laws for Muslims and different laws for Christians, for example, and so forth. Here is a concept of power that could have gravitated, but I think kind of didn't, which is what in the West was called imperium. Now, again, medieval notions of imperium are not, that doesn't just translate simply as empire in English. Sometimes it does, but in many Western medieval theorists, when they were talking about imperium, they were specifically referring to what today we might call a consolidated sovereign state. Yeah. That is a state where the executive has some kind of actual power. Now, you might think that's a pretty low bar to cross, but many medieval states or statelets or whatever didn't. And many medieval emperors didn't. Like, they just literally didn't have that kind of power, no matter what the titles were. They couldn't actually go and say, well, I just want to tax this. The taxes for this region are going to be X. No, they couldn't even do that. They couldn't do that until the 17th or 18th century in some places, right? So the story of, like, Western emerging statehood is one of desperately trying to attain what the theorists in Latin were calling imperium. That is where the executive power has actual power. To recruit, to raise taxes, to issue laws, kind of like across the territory. All right. The Eastern Roman polity had that, and it had that from very, very early on. And there are lots of fascinating moments where Western theorists like Dante or Massilio of Padua and so on are struggling to articulate this sense of, no, we actually want an effective government. Not the, you know, joke that we have today. And in part, they're arguing against, like, papal interference in politics. Like, this fractures any kind of a unified executive when, you know, the Pope, who's some, like, Italian guy in Rome, can just send a document that just kind of completely disrupts the political arrangements in your country or state or whatever, empire, or whatever it is. Well, then you don't have sovereignty. Right? They would look for these models, and they come so close to realizing that the East had this. In fact, we could actually look at it as a model, but they never do. Because I think their prejudice, or the prejudice that they expected their readers to have, just simply wouldn't let them. And so I identify a couple of places in the book where, like, the theory comes close to saying, oh, and by the way, this has existed, and it existed in Constantinople, but they don't actually take that final step, even when they're using materials from Constantinople. That's the crazy thing. Marsilio draws these conclusions from reading the Acts of the Council of Chalcedon, which took place, it's a suburb of Constantinople. Like, there's an Eastern emperor, right? And no, he never says that. So that's appropriation.
Yeah, this is absolutely perfect for my purposes. I'll tell you why, and then I can we can finish up, and I'll give you the last word. I mean, in some ways, the entire anarchist tradition, and you know, going from people like Bakunin and Kropotkin, and especially into someone like James C. Scott, is saying, you know, the liberal tradition got this wrong because they said step one, you need this concept of imperium, you need political sovereignty, you need power, you need violence to be under control. Step two, you need this res publica, you need the violence to in some ways represent popular sovereignty. And once you've got a space where you know who's allowed to hurt people, and you know, the Oscar Wilde's line is, you know, democracy is bludgeoning of the people, for the people, by the people. Once you've got that, once you've got the bludgeoning under control and centralized and under control of the people, you can make a good place and reduce the bludgeoning as much as possible, and people can be free. And what the anarchists say is they look, I mean, Kropotkin does this famously. He looks at the Middle Ages and he says, you know what? There actually wasn't anyone in charge of violence in this period for most places. And that's good, because that meant people could sit together and talk and decide not to have any bludgeoning in their town at all. Whereas the liberal tradition begins with this concept of imperium, finds it necessary. The alternative to imperium is anarchy, and anarchy is the constant violence of everyone against everyone. And the only way to stop anarchy is via imperium and then a republican form of imperium. And George Washington is very clear, republican empire is the goal. And when you work through all this and see the Roman inheritances, it all makes complete sense. And Kropotkin wants to say, and James C. Scott wants to say, no, no, if your starting point is put someone in charge of the violence, you've lost the game, because your political systems are always going to be violent from the beginning. And they could actually be, counterintuitively, if you've imbibed this tradition, less violent if you don't start with imperium. And that's I talk to liberals all the time and I can't make myself understood. They're just like, but Graham, who's going to stop the violence in these communities? I'm like, well, I mean, I assume people would try and talk to each other. And that's, you know, that's a non-starter.
Right. Yeah. This might, obviously something we all struggle with in our thinking. I understand completely what you're saying. So I think it's a difference between, I don't think it's a matter of like, do we ignore the violence or do we pay attention to the problem with violence? I think the problem is one of centering the problem of violence from the start and designing institutions mostly around that, and then maybe adding a few more to deal with like the other kinds of issues. I see this. It creates enormous blind spots, both in the institutions that you construct, but also more fundamentally, it embeds, I think, a false idea about human beings and violence at the core of what you're planning. And I see this. I mean, as a historian, I see this problem play out in just the definitions of the state that are often given, you know, the classic Weberian definition about monopoly over the legitimate exercises of violence and so forth, which I take to be not a definition of the state. It might be something that in some circumstances can be a functional tracker of what a state is. But it's equivalent to saying, well, a human being, I'm going to define a human being as a biped that cracks jokes and laughs. It's like, yeah, okay, I get it. That definition will allow you to pick out the human beings from all of the other kinds of things in the world, in the same way that the Weberian definition of statehood might allow you to pick out states from other kinds of things, like giraffes and mountains. But it's completely wrong-headed if you think about it as a definition, because it's not. for the Roman tradition and the one that I study all the way down, you start with the goal of the thing. What is the goal of the thing? And the goal of the thing, if you're going to have institutions that are so, you know, powerful and extensive, is to promote human welfare, right? Is to make it possible for human beings to flourish together, right? So that means primarily, what are we going, what are we aiming for? Let's center that. And then we can deal with the problem of violence as it emerges in relation to those goals. But our goals are like, if you understand the goals as well, I'm going to bracket this one because we don't say it, is to preserve property and equality. And then suddenly, of course, yes, you have the problem of violence. then you, all of a sudden you're dealing with the problem of violence. But if you start by thinking, what exactly is human flourishing? Like, what do we all collectively want to accomplish here? And it might be something like, I want to be protected from, like, raiders. Okay, it could be that. Look, how do we protect ourselves from raiders? That can be a problem. But also, how about, like, I want to be protected from, you know, hunger and disease and, you know, not having shelter, the cold, the heat, right? Or also, like, I want to have access to books and I want to, you know, like I want to live in a culturally thriving environment where, you know, I can, yeah. So those require a different kind of proactive approach to designing institutions that promote human flourishing. And the violence question is one of those things, but it's not, I don't think, the central one. It's indispensable, I think, of course. But once you start with it and it's like, oh, this is the main problem, then you end up with just coercive institutions and like ICE or whatever. I mean, anyway, yeah, that's my
take. Yeah, no, I think that's right. It's just that's where Hobbes starts. And Hobbes starts with this question. And I just think that most of our political thinkers since him have, you know, Madison famously, I mean, Madison made a pretty good, and I said we were going to end, now I'm talking, but we'll end soon. Madison made a pretty good constitution. Even the anarchists praised Madison's constitution. They were like, you know, the U.S. Constitution, it did a pretty good job, and it was better than what they had before. But he says, and I think it's Federalist Number One, he says, the state must be able to control the people and control itself. That's like in the first paragraph, control the people and control itself. He doesn't mention flourishing is also there. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm not an expert on any of this, but isn't Madison also the one who wrote in one of the papers that the people who own the country should run it?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he's starting from a position of extreme inequality and is creating a system to perpetuate it.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what we have. And that, okay, right. Now, how about if the first principle is something like, the government of the United States, the purpose of it shall be to promote the well-being, welfare, and flourishing of all of its people.
That's see, that's the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah. Yes.
So, you know, and this is, I mean, this is a little too schematic, and here we are on the 250th anniversary, but this is one way of reading it. Madison is, sorry, this is the thing I am an expert on. Madison is often read, and I think this is right, as a synthesis of Hamilton, who is like, power, property, protection, control. Yes. And Jefferson, who is like flourishing, pursuit of happiness. And Madison ends up in between them. But when he writes the Constitution as he does, Hamilton is frustrated with it and Jefferson is outraged. So that tells you which of those two that Madison ultimately swung towards. He went more to control than flourishing.
Yeah. Well,
I took us into my field. Anything else you want to say before we go?
Well, I will thank you for having me on. I hope that this book is a kind of refreshing intervention into an old debate from a different perspective. And I will close with this, that of all of the civilizations that the West has kind of demonized in its course, you know, obviously, there's a long list of those from, you know, Islam to, you know, the Balkans to Eastern Europe to the Far East to the, you know, the New World and the savages and whatever. Like, The concept of Byzantium occupies a unique, special place. It's a vantage point that offers a perspective on the West unlike any other. It's not necessarily the most important one. I'm not saying that, but it's the one that I can study given my expertise. And so I just hope that this is an interesting contribution to that ongoing and long debate.
From where I'm sitting, it is. And, you know, it was brief. And I mean, I love your, not many people, Anthony, can write a document that's obviously scholarly and also I can enjoy reading so much. So there's that's huge for me.
That's huge for me too. I'm very glad it worked out that way. It's difficult to do, I'll say that. I have to rewrite these things many times.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.